Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Laura Carlson of the Center for International Policy, who examines the events leading to the June 28th overthrow of Honduras President Manuel Zelaya, and what role, if any, the U.S. may have had in supporting the coup. Iraqi political analyst Riyad Jarar, who discusses the significance of the June 30th pullback of U.S. combat troops from Iraq's cities, and Vice President Joe Biden's recent visit to Baghdad. And Victor Bolden, corporate counsel for New Haven, Connecticut, who assesses the future impact of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in the case of 20 firefighters who sued the city for reverse discrimination. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The government of Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner suffered a critical defeat in midterm elections, losing control of Congress and significant seats to a dissident faction of the Peronist Party. More surprisingly, former President Néstor Kirchner, the husband of the current president, lost his campaign for a congressional seat in Buenos Aires to another Peronist candidate. Kirchner failed to mobilize poor voters in the district. The loss apparently puts an end to hopes that Mr. Kirchner could run for president again in 2011. Argentina's power couple has become increasingly unpopular over the last year. Problems of the sinking economy, rising inflation, and last year's farmer strike took its toll on President Fernandez's credibility. Polls put her popularity now below 30%. Néstor Kirchner rose to power in the aftermath of the severe 2001 financial crisis and was popular for his tough talk against bankers. He refused to negotiate with bondholders over billions owed in debt. Argentina recovered and Kirchner's popularity soared. But the Kirchner left-of-center agenda faltered when President Fernandez chose to tax agricultural exports to pay for social services for the poor. Farmers rebelled and organized a popular boycott of foodstuffs. In the midterm election, opposition parties who backed the farmers' boycott won key races. In the midst of last fall's economic meltdown, General Electric was given access to a federal government credit program that allowed the corporate giant to access tens of billions of dollars in financing. According to ProPublica and the Washington Post, GE Capital, the industrial giant's finance arm, was first rejected by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in its drive to access the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program, which guarantees short-term debt sold by banks. Even though the industrial giant is not regulated as a bank, GE successfully lobbied to be accepted into the program since it owned two small Utah savings and loans. The Obama administration is calling for finance companies like GE Capital to focus on either banking or commerce, but not both. As a consequence, GE may be forced to spin off GE Capital as a standalone company. In the last 6 months, GE Capital used the short-term government loan guarantees to raise $74 billion in financing to cover cash needs for 2009 and beyond. In the process, GE paid the FDIC $1 billion in fees. Unlike big banks that received federal bailout money, GE did not have to go through the Treasury Department stress test to see how it would perform in a deep recession. It was also not subject to new rules governing risk. Nor did top GE executives have any government limits put on their pay packages. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid grew up in a gold mining town in southern Nevada. His father worked in the mines and eventually became ill from lung disease. Reid's uncle was killed in a mine dynamite blast. Reid, who was running for re-election in 2010, regularly defends the polluting extractive industry and successfully opposed efforts to reform the 1872 General Mining Law, which underwrites gold mining on public lands. Unlike coal, oil, and gas drillers, gold miners are not required to pay royalties to the U.S. government for extracting minerals on public lands. Miners extracted 190 tons of gold in Nevada in 2007, but the days of Nevada's gold rush may be numbered. As Mother Jones magazine reports, Nevada's known gold reserves may be exhausted in 20 years. Since becoming majority leader, Reid has promoted gold interests by pressuring the International Monetary Fund to halt its sales of gold and urged the U.S. Mint to produce more gold coins, which would boost gold prices. In 2007, the House of Representatives passed a mining reform bill that would have imposed a 4% royalty tax on existing mines exploiting U.S. government land. Reid and fellow Nevada Senator John Ensign opposed the bill. The legislation later died over a dispute regarding a provision to study uranium mining on public land. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
After mounting opposition to a non-binding referendum on reforming the Honduran constitution, the military forcibly removed the president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, from power on June 28. After the coup was executed, Zelaya was arrested and flown to Costa Rica by the Honduran military. The leader installed by the coup makers, Roberto Micheletti, insisted that the removal of the elected president at gunpoint was legal, and justified the coup by declaring that Zelaya had broken Honduran law by proceeding with a referendum despite a Supreme Court ruling. Critics of Zelaya's progressive economic policies feared that he would use constitutional reforms to extend his term in office, which is due to end in January 2010. Nations around the world, including the United States, condemned the coup, with the Organization of American States initiating negotiations to restore Zelaya to power. When their efforts failed, OAS members voted unanimously to suspend Honduras from the Hemispheric Organization, which now faces trade sanctions and the loss of loans and aid. On July 5th, Zelaya's attempt to fly back to Honduras was thwarted by the military when they blocked the runway at the Tegucigalpa airport. Soldiers prevented thousands of pro-Zelaya protesters from entering the airport and shot into the crowd, killing at least one activist and injuring dozens. Zelaya's supporters vowed to ratchet up their protests with strikes and by blockading the nation's main highways. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Laura Carlson, director of the Center for International Policy's Americas program based in Mexico City, who examines the events which led to the coup and what role, if any, Washington played in the ouster of President Zelaya.
Mel Zelaya, the president, was elected as a center candidate, and then he fairly soon after his election began to move more toward the left, and particularly to positions that involved, in some ways, redistributing the wealth and having more social programs for the vast majority of the population in Honduras that lives in poverty. Honduras is the third poorest country in the region, and their estimates run from 50 to 70% of the population living in poverty, with over 40% living on less than $2 a day. This explains, too, why there's so many immigrants from Honduras to the United States, because it's just very, very difficult to even make a living there. And the president began to raise minimum wage and carry out other types of programs that infuriated the business class, which is typically, like many of these countries, run by a very small number of very wealthy families. So as he grew further and further away from this political class that included, as we saw in the coup, the Congress and the courts, he grew closer and closer to the grassroots organizations of peasant farmers and labor unions and indigenous peoples throughout the country. And we began to see an even sharper polarization in the country as they realized that they couldn't control a president who was no longer serving their interests. The catalyst for this coup began several days before he was actually kidnapped, when the president announced that he would be carrying out a nationwide survey, basically. It's a non-binding referendum that only said, do you agree to place a fourth urn in the elections in November on calling the Constitutional Assembly? It said nothing about changing term limits. It said nothing about specific proposals for changing the Constitution. So the courts immediately had already ruled that this referendum, or this survey actually, was illegal, and Congress ruled that it was illegal. In fact, they passed a law to make it illegal. The president was following a previously existing law that validated this type of consultation to the people. So there was a conflict between, obviously, the three powers, and all of them were claiming that they had legal and constitutional rights to back up their positions, and it was fairly complicated in that sense. However, the Organization of American States began to hear rumors of a coup before it happened and quickly stepped in to say this would not be acceptable, look for a solution to some of the conflicts that were happening. Many of us thought that that would stave off any type of violent action, but lo and behold, on June 28th, the day that the survey was to be carried out, the president was kidnapped at 5 o'clock in the morning from the presidential residence in his pajamas, flown in an Air Force jet to Costa Rica, and the army blocked carrying out in most places this non-binding referendum.
Laura, I wanted to ask you about any fingerprints from Washington that could be detected here in either foreknowledge of the coup or other maybe covert support for the coup, either with President Obama's knowledge or without, that you have detected here.
What some people say is that the very fact that the coup happened and that the United States, as well as other countries, but in particular the United States, was involved in dialogue before the coup happened, is evidence that the United States supported it. Their argument runs that the United States has so much power in this small, very poor country, both historically and because of the dependence of Honduras on the U.S. economy, for its own economy, that if they had been serious about stopping this coup, they could have, because the coup leaders wouldn't dare to do it if the United States in those discussions beforehand had been firm about it. I don't find this to be a completely convincing argument. For one thing, it's not real evidence. And I think in these things, we have to be looking at evidence, because you can always speculate. And the other thing is, most people were surprised that they actually carried this out. And their attitude since then has indicated that this is a group of people that has thrown all caution to the wind and decided that they're going to do this no matter what the international community does, no matter what the United States does, and no matter what the Organization of American States and the European Union and almost, like I say, every other country in the world does. There's been talk from the beginning, especially by the Venezuelan government, of the involvement of former U.S. diplomats, in particular Otto Reich, a very conservative former State Department person under the Bush administration and others, as part now of non-governmental organizations. It will be a big challenge for many of us who work in investigative journalism or analysis to begin to sort this out and to see what some of these so-called democracy promotion programs are doing in the hemisphere. And although we don't have any evidence of this yet, I would say that it's possible that there is that kind of involvement. It's, of course, certainly worth investigating and finding out as much as anyone possibly can about the lead-up and how this group of people became so confident as to carry out an act like this in the 21st century.
That was Laura Carlson, director of the Center for International Policy's Americas program, based in Mexico City. Contact the center by calling area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at americaspolicy.org. When U.S. combat troops pulled out of Iraq's cities and towns on June 30th, as stipulated in the Status of Forces Agreement signed by former President George Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in November 2008, many Iraqi citizens celebrated the milestone in the streets. But about 130,000 American soldiers remain in the country, with the timeline for their complete withdrawal set for the end of 2011. Another 132,000 military contractors, 36,000 of whom are American citizens, also remain deployed across Iraq. According to recent public opinion polls published in the Brookings Institution's Iraq Index, 73% of Iraqis oppose the presence of coalition forces. If voters reject the Status of Forces timetable for withdrawal in a scheduled national referendum set for July 30th, U.S. troops could be forced to leave Iraq more quickly. Iraqi opposition and insurgent groups, including the Association of Muslim Scholars, a Sunni clerical organization, and Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, marked the June 30th pullback of U.S. forces by urging their followers to continue fighting the American military until it had left the country completely and to refrain from launching attacks on fellow Iraqis. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Iraqi political analyst Raed Jarar, a consultant to the American Friends Service Committee's Iraq program. He discusses the significance of the June 30th pullback of U.S. combat troops out of Iraq cities and the negative fallout from Vice President Joe Biden's recent visit to Baghdad.
Well, I think the majority of people are thrilled. They are very happy that the U.S. is leaving, because the vast majority of the Iraqi public, regardless of their ethnicity or sect, are and have been demanding a complete U.S. withdrawal, a withdrawal that leaves no permanent bases and no troops and no contractors behind. Now, the celebrations that took place last week, I think there are two major reasons that pushed people to celebrate. One of them is that this step is actually significant, that Iraqis will not have to undergo the daily humiliation of living under a foreign occupation, seeing foreign troops rolling down their streets, stopping at checkpoints, etc., all of the other foreign occupation symptoms, that they would not have to deal with it on a daily basis. And from my point of view, I think it's even more important step that Iraqis now have more hope that the Obama administration is serious about its implementation of the withdrawal agreement. Now, Iraqis are not thrilled about the current situation. Iraq is still under a foreign occupation. It's still not a sovereign country. The U.S. is still interfering in Iraq's politics. But I think the end goal of the agreement, which is the final and complete departure of all U.S. troops and contractors, and the final and complete closure of all U.S. military bases and posts, that's the thing that Iraqis will be really celebrating.
Raed, we've been reading about a spike of violence, renewed suicide bombings in some of the cities and marketplaces, and there have been threats by Sunni insurgents as well as Muqtada al-Sadr and his militia that they are encouraging their men under arms to attack U.S. soldiers. Could this not change the dynamic in Iraq and somehow derail the schedule for the withdrawal of U.S. troops? How real a threat is that, do you think?
On the one hand, the explosions that took place in the last few weeks, they were not suicide explosions. They were all by empty cars, like left-behind cars or trucks. These high-profile attacks that took place in the last few weeks are obviously designed and implemented to sabotage the plan of withdrawal. The timing of the attacks highly suggests that people behind it are not happy with the withdrawal plan. So they were trying to put bombs to justify a longer occupation or to pressure the Obama administration and the al-Maliki government to postpone or cancel the plans of withdrawal. Now, armed resistance groups, including the remains of the old Ba'ath Party and some nationalist groups in the west of the country and middle and north, and Muqtada al-Sadr as a nationalist in the south, they actually all happened to give statements in the last couple of weeks ordering anyone who works with them to stop any attacks inside Iraqi cities and towns and villages. Many of them have said that they will continue resisting the U.S. occupation if the U.S. showed signs that it's planning a long-term occupation, that they will continue attacks on U.S. bases outside cities or whatever. But so far, there has been a number of announcements that show that even people who have been fighting against the Iraqi government for the last few years are actually now taking the Iraqi government's side.
What do you think Vice President Biden's mission to Baghdad has been over these last few days during his trip in the early part of July?
We see Biden going to Baghdad and interfering with Iraq's domestic issues and bringing up all of these old agendas of sectarianism and division. It was pretty negative overall. I think the visit was received very negatively by the Iraqi parliament, and even the prime minister himself condemned Biden's attempt to interfere in Iraq's political process and rejected an offer given by Biden to hold an Iraqi reconciliation conference in Washington, D.C. I don't think any Iraqis in general don't think that the U.S. has enough political capital or moral authority to help Iraqis reconcile. So, I mean, I think the visit overall was negative. I wish that there is someone else who was sent to Iraq other than Biden, because his name is linked to a plan of partitioning and sectarianism in Iraq.
That was political analyst Raed Jarar, a consultant to the American Friends Service Committee's Iraq program. Read more about the group's Wage Peace campaign at their website, countdowntowithdrawal.org. On June 29th, the Supreme Court announced a 5-4 decision in the Ricci versus DeStefano case, in which 20 New Haven, Connecticut firefighters, 19 white and one Latino, sued the city, claiming racial discrimination. The city had declined to certify promotion tests given in 2003, in which no African American and only two Latino fighters scored high enough to be promoted. The suit was filed in 2004, and since the city had thrown out the tests, no one has been promoted for the past 7 years. Although the percentages of whites, blacks, and Hispanics in the department at that time did not differ too much from the racial makeup of the city as a whole, whites were somewhat overrepresented, and much more so in leadership positions. 18 of the department's 21 captains were white. Decisions in the district and appellate courts supported the city's position that the test results were discriminatory on their face, and certifying them would be a violation of Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But the Supreme Court reversed those rulings, stating the city's fear of a lawsuit by black firefighters was not a good enough reason to deny promotions to the firefighters who scored well. Now the case goes back to the district court, where most observers expect the judge to order the city's Civil Service Commission to certify the 2003 exam results. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Victor Bolden, the City of New Haven's Corporation Counsel, whose job it was to defend the city's handling of the exam results. Bolden explains how it came to be that the city had to give so much weight to a written exam, and what impact this Supreme Court decision could have on future discrimination cases.
There was a memorandum of understanding between the city and the firefighters that goes back into the 1980s, in which it sort of set weights for how any sort of civil service examination or process was going to be scored, and the weighting was 60% for the written portion and 40% for the oral. And that is actually significant in terms of understanding the, A, one, in terms of sort of the disparate impact, but two, understanding the difficulty the city was going to have in trying to say this test is actually job-related, in that the weighting of the exam was done by a process some 20 years ago and not done and calibrated for the particular examination that was going to be administered here. And there, you know, there's certainly some testing experts have talked about, and I think there was certainly testimony before the Civil Service Board about how that kind of weighting, you know, often can disfavor minority candidates. It isn't a question of not having the knowledge, it's just a question of, is that really the right way to sort of gauge who's actually going to be the best lieutenant or best captain for the job?
Was there any part of the promotion tests that involved actual firefighting practice?
That's an excellent question. I mean, one of the concerns that actually certainly had been illuminated through the course of the Civil Service Board hearings was whether or not the City of New Haven had been using a more antiquated process for deciding who could be leaders. I mean, again, everyone who took the exam is a member of the fire department, and they're all firefighters. They've already reached some threshold level of, you know, in terms of their competence and expertise. And the question then is, who among that group are the people best situated to be leaders? And there was discussion about sort of the assessment centers, which really sort of more tries to sort of capture how people would respond in particular situations rather than simply asking them to study material and, you know, give it back in a multiple choice format. And there's some that say that that actually provides a better sense of how someone's going to respond to the real world situations that firefighters face.
But in New Haven, that wasn't used at all?
That was not used, and that was certainly one of the concerns. The members of the Civil Service Board, and indeed the two members who voted not to certify, both of them expressed concerns about whether or not the testing process was sufficient. They had concerns about whether or not this actually was the right test. You know, that was one of the, and it was certainly the prime motivation behind their decision-making process.
Victor Bolden, some experts say this ruling will have very little impact on employment discrimination law beyond this one instance in New Haven, and others say it's a major reinterpretation of civil rights law. What do you think?
There is obviously a new standard that the Supreme Court has put in place, and there has been some questioning, if not an undermining, of a key provision of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And the concept of disparate impact was sort of first recognized by the Supreme Court itself in a unanimous opinion in Griggs v. Duke Power Company in 1971. Those very principles were sort of codified by Congress and made expressly a part of the Civil Rights Act in 1991 by Congress. We now have the U.S. Supreme Court casting considerable doubt on, if not the constitutionality, the viability of using disparate impact as a means of guiding employers and protecting employees in the workplace from discrimination on the basis of race, gender, ethnicity, or religion, not only in terms of the most overt practices, but in any form. So on a meta level, there's the question about what's happened to Title VII. Has Title VII now been rewritten or at least curtailed by the actions of the U.S. Supreme Court? On another level, are employers who now have to understand and work with the new standard that the Supreme Court has put in place, which is if they are faced with the kind of dilemma that the city of New Haven is, where there is the prospect of a suit under the Title VII's disparate impact provisions, but there also may be the prospect of someone then claiming that there is a basis for a suit under disparate treatment, there is the new standard of an employer having to make sure that if they decide to use another process, that they're going to need to have a strong basis and evidence for doing so, although it's not entirely clear what that strong basis is. It's something short of a violation, but seemingly something more than simply statistical evidence that there's a racial disparity. So that's sort of a secondary level, that employers have to deal with, meet what, and understand this new standard. And then obviously the third level is the one most immediate to the city of New Haven, and what's my primary concern, which is figuring out what the decision means for the city going forward when we go back to the district court, as well as what does it mean for the city going forward beyond that in terms of how it looks at civil service exams and how it makes decisions about how it's going to both hire and promote civil service employees and ensure they have the best people, but also able to take advantage of the great diversity that this city has as well as the nation has as well.
That was Victor Bolden, Corporation Counsel for the City of New Haven, Connecticut. For more information and analysis on the case, visit SCOTUSblog.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.